So, yeah, it was the day you and I helped my kid move his shit.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
I got home, and I got to feeling kind, because when you order a pizza, you have the stupid rewards programs, and right? And they just points build up, right?
Sure.
And I'm like, the kid clearly has an empty home. He's stopping by my house to get the very last of his crap at, like, 8:30 at night. Wouldn't it be cool if his dad just, like, sent him a pizza, right? To just,
right,
here you go. And I'm going to use my pizza point, so it's really going to cost me next to nothing. Like, delivery fee and tip is what I'm in for, right?
Right.
So I pull up the two big chains that are around in the area, and I plug in his address, and I start looking at which one's going to be the more affordable option. Mm-hmm. And as we know, for the last handful of months or so, I've been trying to minimize my carbohydrate intake outside of beer.
Yeah, okay.
You know, I like baby steps, right? And so
pizzas, you've changed beer to vodka.
That's another reason I have been using the vodka. I'm minimizing the carbohydrate. I'm trying to minimize even the beer carbs now. But anyhow, so I work it out and I order him a pizza. And while I'm doing this, I decide that, you know, it's been a long time since I had a fucking pizza. Fuck it. I deserve a pizza, and I've got the points on the other one open already. So I just complete and place my order, right? I get a phone call 45 minutes later. Hi, we're at the gate, and we don't know how to get in. I'm like, oh, crap. Double oh crap, because I have to learn how to use my phone and call my kid. Well, I text my kid a couple of times. He doesn't respond. I call him. I send him a text message eventually, like, answer the fucking phone. It's really right now. And because you can see what's happened here, yes. Right? And he does call me back. And he's like, what the fuck, Dad? I'm on the phone with my girlfriend. I was like, dude, I really fucked up. I need you to go to the gate and get the pizza. He's like, I already got the pizza. I'm having some. I was like, nope. You have to go get my pizza. He's like, what? I was like, just go fucking do it. I'll explain it later. Dad, you're a pain in the ass. And he's cussing me about blowing up the air mattress the whole time because I told him to be like blowing up an air mattress manually is a free high and he doesn't understand that. And he didn't enjoy it nearly as much as I do. And he's just angry as shit. Well, so as it turns out, I never went back and changed the address, obviously. And I sent my kid two pizzas. One with his toppings and one with mine.
So how does he like pepperoni and jalapeno?
Banana pepper and pineapple and pepperoni. But yeah,
okay.
You were very close. So the next day I figured I'd just going to let it sit. He went and got the pizza. Everybody's happy. And now I've got to figure out what to eat for dinner. And luckily I'm a grown up and have food in the house. So I just went and cooked something that was in the cupboards, which is probably what I should have done in the first place. But,
that's sad,
so,
man.
I know. It is very sad. I text him the next day, like, I'm really pretty fucking bummed because I got myself hyped up for a pizza because I haven't had one in quite a while. And he's like, well, it's still in the refrigerator right along with the Mountain Dew you ordered. I'm like, no. Like, it is literally the least I can do as your parent to fuck up to your benefit. Just have two pizzas. Like, there is literally nothing.
I don't know. Moving him without him there, that was pretty big.
Well, yeah, but like,
but
the least I can do is literally to just accidentally fuck up and have it work out for you, which has been kind of my code of parenting for a long time.
Well, yes, you have. your version of parenting has been one of benevolent neglect. I mean, it has.
Or the opposite.
It hasn't worked for the plants, it's always worked for you.
I've been known to helicopter once in a while, you know, just to fill in the spaces. But that was my big win for the week. Fucking idiot. Rupert doesn't understand because Rupert doesn't live anywhere where anybody can deliver a pizza.
There's none of that.
Yeah, like you'd have to hire a cab and pay them $40 to drive from town to your house.
Yeah.
That would be one fucked up carry out. Yeah, I'm going to have a carry out, but it's going to be the Oregon taxi driver. He's going to pick that up, and then he's going to take it to my place. So that pizza that's going to cost you $10 for their carry out special is now $60.
Like, exactly. Well, you might be able to Uber Eats it all the way out to your house. But
it's still going to be $60.
A, fuck Uber, and B,
that's still going to be a $60 fucking thing for a $5 pizza.
Yeah, I just, I don't know.
You can see Rupert's head just kind of exploding.
So that's my story. I'm sticking to it. Should we move into the next thing that's going to make Rupert's head explode?
Sure, why not?
Ladies and gentlemen, and everyone else listening, we are Ruined Heroes, a weekly free and self-produced podcast wherein the three of us irreverently discuss a topic of societal renown. I, Tyler, study like a guy who is muted. John.
I'm going to get new speakers.
Pretty soon. Maybe, because... And Rupert.
I'm just here.
And your speakers are still
there
in the mail.
Still in Utah.
So, you could just drive and go get them.
No, because he has to pick up plywood on the way for them to finish the build, I think, is the story.
Yeah, pretty much it.
So please subscribe and leave good ratings and reviews on whatever podcast feed you get us through. Not the most recent new review, which is it took him 9 minutes to even mention the name's topic or the topic's name.
That's nice.
That's called formatting. Listen to three of them. It's always that way. Mm-hmm. Get the fuck over it.
Plus, if you're listening to it, the topic name is sort of...
Yeah, it's right there. They knew what they were getting into, but they're like, it was 9 minutes till they even said it was the Bob Ross episode.
So what?
Like, what the fuck ever? Get the fuck over yourself.
You can leave the bad ones. We like them.
Well, we're clearly talking about them. Leave the bad reviews, too, but we do like the better ones where you actually have some familiarity with what the fuck is going on. We're not for everybody. We didn't ever ask to be. So, yeah, please subscribe and all that shit. It's free for you. It helps us to interact with us. We are RuinedHeroesPod@gmail.com, as well as easily found on Facebook and Twitter, where you get weekly hints. Say hi when you drop by and take a guess at the hints. We dig about all that stuff. If you would like to help with the cost of the show, you can subscribe at patreon.com/ruinedheroes and get extra content starting at just $1 a month. There are links in the show notes down below where you click to play, as well as on our website, ruinedheroes.com. Thank you to those of you who do give. We appreciate it.
Yeah, you're kind
of
awesome.
Pretty fucking cool.
Thank you.
Thank you again to Nikki. Things. Even if we don't need the air conditioner today, Nikki still gets to thank you for the air conditioner.
Yeah, because it's still in the window, and we don't know if
we
need
might
it again.
Need it again. Like, and if not, it'll still be in the window next August. So, intro. The topic said this, so it's a person. If you understood everything I said, you'd be me.
I feel like we've had that hint for most of the person interviews.
A lot of people say episodes. Shit similar to that. Agreed.
If you understood what I said, you'd be me?
If you understood everything I said, you'd be me.
Okay. Marlon Brando.
Mm-mm. But kind of the right arena. Kind of the right arena. Of course, now there's noise kicks in.
That's because you started talking.
Yeah, right. Next one is also by the top. In fact, all of them except for... I've got five, and all of them except for the last are by the topic. So this one... Someday, I'm going to call me up on the phone. So when I answer, I can tell myself to shut up. Tell me this isn't shit we've all thought about on our own, right?
We've done George Carlin.
We have done George Carlin.
Okay.
Also, oddly not distant, anyone can play. The note is only 20%. The attitude of the motherfucker who plays it is 80%. So now we've narrowed your field of people, right?
Miles Davis?
Nailed it! Nicely done. Fuck the next two. They don't really matter. Sources. MilesDavis.com. AllMusic.com. Biography.com. Arts.gov/honors. And LATimes.com. And Encyclopedia.com. I don't know why they didn't show up as a link, but whatever the fuck. That way I do, because poor editing on my part. Anyhow, those are the sources. Born Miles Dewey Davis III, May 26, 1926, in Alton, Illinois, to parents Miles Dewey Davis Jr. Luckily, that happened, because we've had it when it didn't, who was a dental surgeon, and Cleota May Davis, a music teacher. And violinist. He was the middle of three children. His grandparents owned a decent-sized pig farm in Arkansas, where the kids would often spend the summers fishing, hunting, and doing all the other shit that kids did or hanging out on the farmland do, right? Raising a ruckus, as my grandma used to say. So not long after he was born, the family moved to East St. Louis, and the Great Depression set in. This left Dad working as much as he could, which made him kind of unavailable to the kids, which is not uncommon. Be that as it may, it is around 12 to 13 when Dad is said to have introduced young Miles III to the trumpet. He took to it quickly and started studying with a friend of his father's, possibly a client, a patient, I guess is the word, right? When you're a dentist.
Theoretically, yeah. I'd go with patient instead of client.
Okay, so yeah, I mean, possibly a patient, depending on what you're reading. But dude's name was Elwood Buchanan. He was a music teacher, director, and musician. Young Miles says Elwood was one of the largest influences, one of his largest influences in music. One unique thing Buchanan taught was to play the trumpet without vibrato, which was counter to most of the players at the time. So think about like Louis Armstrong as an example. They all did a lot of vibrato, and removing that made you stand out and kind of be aside. This was perhaps the first major stylistic development for Miles Davis we know today. As a decent student who was also learning about the street in St. Louis, Miles started to play gigs with local bands by the time he was in high school. Eventually, he took a standing spot in Eddie Randall's Blue Devils,
This is what happens when Tyler gets technology. Okay.
He took a standing spot in Eddie Randall's Blue Devils, which was a St. Louis-based band. This led him to being asked to fill in for an ailing trumpet player in Billy Eckstein's big band alongside Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker. He was only 17 years old. So, that says something, right? It's not just me.
Well, hello, Charlie.
I mean, I went to school with a guy like that that was the mad first chair sax player that, like, if jazz musicians rolled into town and were missing a saxophone for whatever reason, be they ill or out on another gig or something, they would call this kid that sat the chair above me in high school. And, like, that was an unobtainable spot for me. I wasn't a bad sax player, but this guy was just fucking amazing. And it sounds like this is where Miles is at that point.
Yeah, there's no way you're getting first chair there. Right. It's just, you know, you might as well learn a new instrument from scratch.
Yeah.
You know, go ahead and learn how to play the triangle at this point, because that's about as good as you're going to get compared to this guy.
Yeah, I knew a kid like that.
Yeah, those ones that are just so fucking good that...
No, he would always sit in with these guys. Miles Evans.
What's the guy's name?
Miles Evans. He was a trumpet player. I think he was a year younger than me or something like that. But he was always sitting in with these guys when we were growing up. His father, having been Gil Evans, gave him a little bit of a entree into it. Huh. And the fact that he was named after Miles Davis would be the other.
This guy's
like, he knew Miles Davis.
My dude's name, he was a sax player, as I said. Yeah. His name was Eric Gibb. No relation, but I think it might have helped.
But, like, at that time, like, you know, Charlie Parker was, he went off to St. Louis and stuff and basically hitched a freight train.
Yeah, you recently read one of his biographies, right?
Yeah, yeah. Stanley Crouch wrote a biography about Charlie Parker and that whole thing. And, like, what he had to go through to get anywhere, like... No, nobody was showing him up with a hard luck story.
No. Like, Charlie climbed ridiculous. Somebody else's bootstraps to find his own, and yeah, it was a hard knock life. But he was the guy that kind of built bebop jazz, and then you got Dizzy Gillespie, fucking legend, right? Like, who doesn't know Puffer Cheeks? At 17 years old, you're playing with these guys. That's something. It is kind of time and place too. Like, I don't know that we have jazz heroes like that right now. Either way, somewhere in here, he and then girlfriend Irene Cawthon, I think is how it's said, Cawthon. Go with me, Cawthon. You think?
Think so.
gave birth to their first of three children, Cheryl. The couple would split when Miles moves soon after, but they would reunite a couple of more times so they could, of course, have the other kids. In 1944, he talked his parents into letting him take a scholarship to Juilliard, which is a Facebook hint. It was then called the Institute of Musical Arts in New York. It could be the other round. Like some histories say that his parents talked him into it. His website says that they just agreed, so there's no answer there. But like, depending on who you're reading, it's either he did it, they did it, doesn't matter. He ends up going to Juilliard, New York. And this was just what Miles wanted, as he intended on finding his idol, Charlie Parker, again, and getting to work with him. It didn't take long for Miles to become a part of the growing jazz scene and eventually earning the spot he wanted, trumpet to Parker's saxophone. So, 18 years old, maybe 19 at this point. He's spent some time.
He's in living the dream.
Yeah.
I mean, this is quite literally a...
You're going to fucking Juilliard. It's not like he came from a shotgun house.
The back of my head is screaming, it's Juilliard, isn't it?
Juilliard, yeah.
Thank you.
It's one of the many reasons they never let me in.
You probably never tried. But you'll lament the fact that you never got in for the rest of your life.
Yes, I will.
That was actually a joke that, remember Russ, my friend?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We were talking when he was first meeting you. It was like, y'all don't even know how much you've got in common. He can play damn near every instrument there is. And then he's like, okay, what? And then Russ looked at me when I was up in Portland. He's like, well, between him and I think we've got them all covered then. Because he played pretty much all the rest of them,
all
too.
The other ones, yeah. All the brass side of the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So, yeah, I did not live up to expectations. That's why I do this. So, 1 year later, Miles dropped out of Juilliard and to pursue his music career full-time. This gave him the space to take up full-time work again, and he joined Benny Carter's band in 1945 through 1946, then Eckstein's band from 46 through 47, and eventually became a full-time member of Parker's band. Story says he also played during this time with the likes of Monk and Mingus and many other groundbreakers at the time. He was steeped in the jazz culture. Went there, found it, stayed there.
Yeah. It's once you find your love, you just kind of go and you live in that area. It is what it is.
Yeah. And perfect birth for what is, as we all know, going to become a legend. He made the big time recording, or he made his big time recording debut as the leader of his own group in 1947 with Parker on sax, John Lewis on piano, Nelson Boyd on bass, and Max Roach on drums. The lineup was about as sweet as it could get at the time. He continued as a regular member of Parker's band, but was obviously growing in his own right, as well as playing drop-in sets with Sonny Rollins, Thelonious Monk, as I mentioned earlier, and many others. I mean, like, again, steeped in the scene. Yeah. He just was playing with all the best of the best. And still the names, when you talk about jazz, these are the names that come up. These are the people.
That was when we talked about, you just like, there's too many. Just pick one and I'll do it. I was...
Yeah, right. Actually, John technically picked this one because I was like, I just got too many to pick from. This is where I'm heading. Pick a jazz musician.
Mm-hmm.
And I was torn between Thelonious and Miles. And I mean, just M comes first. M comes first in the alphabet. There you go.
M for Monk. I would have loved that one, too. I love that guy. And he's got a great story. And I could rewatch that movie around midnight. It's been a while. So in 1949, Miles assembled a 9-piece ensemble containing a huge horn section complete with tuba, baritone sax, played by Jerry Mulligan, another great name, and French horn. It was an odd sound for the time, but it worked. The band influenced the new and changing sound of jazz and got a recording contract with Capitol Records. The 12 tracks they produced were released as The Birth of Cool in 1957. So what is that, like 8-9 years later, something like that? 49 is when they record them. They don't get released until 57.
So they
I wrote it down. I did the math about 8 years later. Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So they recorded it.
Yeah.
And then held on.
And the Capitol set on it.
Because Miles Davis had gotten bigger at this point, and they could get somewhere with it. I guess.
I don't know.
That's kind of weird.
It is like, and that is a seminal jazz album.
Yeah, that's
it's groundbreaking.
One of the big ones.
And for Capitol Records to sit on it for almost nine years is very strange to me.
Well, if you're talking releasing it in 59, you're sort of like right when like bebop is sort of at its height, and that's when, you know, jazz sort of takes a little bit of a hiatus from big band swing of the 40s and 30s.
Yeah.
And then it moves into bebop, which becomes popular music. That's popular music.
It, especially, yeah, in the hip cat world, yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, bebop was, like, only 5 years. So, you know, what are you going to do? Now
it's so weird thinking that bebop was so short, but
it was. Yeah, it was really very short-lived. But it revolutionized jazz to, you know, sort of being a popular music form where people had records of it and were really listening to it. Whereas, like, big band swing, in terms of the home environment, you know, stereos weren't that great, and it was really just sort of, like, if you listen to big band swing...
Sounds like it's you're listening to it through a can.
Yeah, if you listen to big band swing on a 1940 stereo, you got background music there, you know? But then, like, stereo moves along, and now we're into sort of the late 50s, and bebop is out. That sounds better on a 50s stereo, and, you know, people can get into it.
And it's very much musicians' music or audiophile music. People get really into how
it's recorded.
Yeah, way
better recording techniques.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it really becomes it kind of the height of you're only cool if you can listen to the bebop at this point in time.
Yeah.
And it's just weird to me, again, that album was sat on for so long, because it was the thing.
Yeah.
It is, you know. Another thing that happened during this album is that he started playing mostly muted trumpet, which, again, this is maybe the second thing that helps define
that
the Miles Davis sound.
That certainly defines his sound.
Yeah. Yeah. So we've got the no vibrato, and we've got the muted trumpet now.
Yeah.
And I didn't write these to count them, like often I do, so we'll see if we can keep track. But there's a number of little things that he does that define Miles Davis. So, having been in New York City and succeeding, Irene Cawthon and his daughter join him again. They move in together, and eventually Charlie Parker ends up living there for a little bit of while.
Just because.
Well, I mean, like, if you know anything about Parker, there was a lot of addiction issues in the jazz scene of the time. It wasn't just bebop that was becoming cool. Heroin. You know?
Yeah, go figure.
So anyhow, yeah, Charlie Parker apparently lived there for a while. Parker was well known to have issues around addiction, and this may have been the beginning of Miles' drugs use. Nobody can pin it, but it's the right time and place. It could also just be a side effect of the jazz scene in general. Either way, Miles took to a heavy heroin use by 1950. He became abusive at home and unpredictable on stage and in the studio. This slowed his work significantly until 1954, when he kicked the drug cold turkey at home, which was also fucking volatile. Like, if you've ever seen somebody kick cold turkey, it can be really rough. The couple split due to these issues. He is also known to have frequented sex workers during this time and borrowing from friends during the time, but again, not that unusual. He may also have dabbled in some, and quote, pimpin'. That's from his website, not like... And it's quoted that he might have done some pimping during the time. It is also said that Davis was jailed for lack of child support payment somewhere in here, but I didn't look too far into that either. So, I mean, not
so he
great
facilitated
time.
The production of children and not paying them. And not paying for them.
Apparently.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's what he did. He facilitated the production of children and people not paying for those children.
But
bang that on the mic stand.
Man, you gotta kind of really fuck up to get jailed for child support back then.
Yeah.
That's pretty
rough.
You know?
It Well, and to get jailed for child support while you're pimping?
Well, that's just tacky.
Okay, that wasn't pimping. That what that was whoring. You were whoring yourself around.
Sex worker. Mm-hmm. That's not whoring. Sex worker.
No, he was whoring himself around.
Oh.
Which I think is still okay to say, but I don't know.
Sex worker, no.
He was sex. Worker. He was his own sex
professionals.
He was pimping himself.
Oh, dude, have you seen the fucking hubbub about OnlyFans? Oh, my Lord, we should talk about that.
No, we shouldn't.
But...
so many things we should not talk about. That is chief among them.
It is just a curious world to be stuck in. But, I mean, heroin. Surprise. Bad shit happens when heroin's around. So he got off heroin just in time to play his now very famous rendition of Round Midnight at the Newport Jazz Festival in July 1955. Having been working with the smaller Prestige label, who was willing to put up with his addiction and kind of bullshit, this performance caught the eyes of Columbia Records and opened a whole new set of doors for Miles. So, sober, Newport Jazz Festival is kind of a jazz thing, and Round Midnight, also kind of a jazz thing.
It's amazing what somebody who's just starting out as a company, the amount of bullshit that they're willing to put up with just to get somebody that's got a name behind them. Like, okay, you know what, we'll go ahead and we'll deal with it. But then they realize that they have to get their act together. And then it's like, fuck, he's more of a liability than an asset now. See, before he was more of an asset than a liability because they had nothing to lose.
Right.
Now that when, you know, a company starts building and they got something to lose, now it's like, yeah, your liability outweighs your asset in this one.
And he is really kind of on the precipice of all of that. He's on the brink of being a problem, but... they still want him around, but this like this Columbia thing sounds like a good way out, right? Especially since he's sobered up, and Columbia wasn't a small record label. At that
no,
point in time.
Which means that they don't have to just use him as the asset or the liability. They can weigh him against others. It's
yeah.
Like, okay, is he going to add to the stable?
So another big deal happened in 1955. Miles was diagnosed and operated on for his first throat polyps. The first ones. The good news is that it may have offered more space for his airstream. Like, when they removed the polyps, it may have literally caused his air... your trachea is your air,
better
right?
Flow.
Yeah. Like, it may have actually opened his trachea and allowed more air to go through, giving him kind of a superpower, if you will. But it also started to fuck up with his speech. So this is another thing that becomes intrinsically Miles, is that... that itonic way of jazz talk that he has, that smoky, gravelly pit voice and kind of struggled way with spaces in between, another thing that becomes quintessentially Miles Davis. Like, if you've heard
him... people say that Alana Miles has that smoky voice.
She does.
That's the smoky voice we're talking about here. It's just that little unnamed thing... That not quite definable, like, this is what sets you apart. That's what it is.
Yeah, and this isn't...
You're this is born with it, or you can medical.
Yeah, I mean, so there is the opening of his airways to increase his trumpet force, but he loses all the speech force, and so, like, his stage presence... He'd always been kind of closed off, but his stage presence becomes even more closed off because he struggles to speak, and he does, like, here's my new song, and then, like, beep! And then turns his back to the audience, you know? and it is even further defining this elementally cool persona. I'm surprised you don't have more to say.
He's kind of a bad boy.
Yeah, he is. You know, he's done the heroin. He's been a little abusive. He's starting to leave a string of kids across the country. He's
racking up all... he's putting all the checks in the boxes.
Yeah.
He really is.
Yeah.
And we're what? We're in the 60s?
We're 55. We aren't in the 60s quite yet.
We're getting close.
Yeah. So he used his new contract to assemble what would become a long-standing band lineup to work with him, featuring Red Garland on piano, Paul Chambers on bass, Philly Joe Jones on drums, and up-and-coming John Coltrane on saxophones. So
I stayed away from Coltrane intentionally.
You can kind of credit our knowledge of John Coltrane to Miles Davis. Like, Coltrane probably would have been discovered anyway. Much like Davis wandered into the jazz scene, Coltrane did. But he hired him. And I was like, this is a talent.
Coltrane and Davis are like Plato and Socrates.
They... Fair. Fair. Who does that make? Charlie Parker, because he's got to be older than those
God.
Two.
Or God's dog.
May have gone too far on
God's
that one.
Noah.
But that's a pretty star lineup if you've got like Red Garland on piano and Philly Joe Jones on drums.
Right.
You know.
And then you bring in this new coming young guy, Coltrane. And you've got the coolest guy on the planet currently, Miles Davis on lead. It's
Can you imagine the first show that they ever played live being there like the first time you hear Coltrane?
Oh my God.
He's a backup. he's not Coltrane yet.
I have seen some truly great jazz musicians in my life, but never any of these guys, because they was all dead for the most part. And oh man.
But just see, like, Miles Davis needs this for his band because, like, another thing he introduces is this idea of having, you know, several people doing a song and handing off the soloist role.
Yeah.
And very much so. So he sort of really brings this to the fore, which works very well with bebop because at the time bebop, the big shift there is shifting more emphasis to the drums as being sort of a driving force rather than...
And everybody else plays over it. And what he's done is he's taken everybody as an individual to play melody as opposed to the swirly part. And he's
got a great drummer there who can drive it and, you know, a piano to sort of keep it going along and stuff and then just hand off between him and John Coltrane for his soloing.
Yeah.
And it works well.
It works really well. They released their first album on Columbia titled after the song that had gotten Miles the notice. Round Midnight. So the initial album called Round Midnight. Other people did albums Round Midnight. I prefer the Monk version myself, but whatever. It's also a motherfucker because it starts out like 12-4 or some shit. It's been a while since I played it, but it's kind of a motherfucker. And there's a lot of time changes. But he's making it. Making it in the classical musician way. He was also still under contract with Prestige for five more albums. So... You know, much like Prince or anybody else, like you move and now you're contracted to two people, right? He solved this by alternately recording albums for each label. So, like, one for Prestige, one for Columbia, one for Prestige, one for Columbia.
Hey, did it work?
He banged out a fucking... Yeah, this allowed him to release a fuck ton of music for the next handful of years. It was during this time that he started to experiment with using effects pedals for his trumpet mic. Again, I think we're up to five or six things now that really defines what Miles Davis is. But it is, again, part of his sound that would become his signature. Like nobody,
yeah, where's my wah-wah pedal?
Yeah. Nobody had hooked a wah pedal to a horn ever before. And Miles, I'm currently sober world.
Pulls and I'm not going to talk, so I might as well do something else funky.
Yeah. And another totally groundbreaking move. Like, nobody had done it. So, in December of 1957, he landed in Paris to improvise the soundtrack to... This is in French, so drink right now. La Censure pour la Echafaude. I don't know. Translates to Elevator of the Gallows, or Elevator to the Gallows. He went to Paris to record and improvise the soundtrack to this movie that I'm not going to try and say the name again, but it means Elevator to the Gallows. It was obviously a fucking artsy movie, and it is also a Facebook hint. The music he and his band produced would be released in 1960, so 3 years later. Again, they're sitting on his good work, and earn him his first Grammy nomination for Best Jazz Performance Solo or Small Group. So, 3 years sitting on his shit just so he can get some accolades again. There's something struggling about the way he moves through life and the record companies work with him that does this to him over and over. I don't know what it is, but maybe it's because he's ahead of his time. They're waiting for the right time to drop it. Like, as Rupert brought up earlier, waiting for the bebop scene to become perfectly
big, or they're thinking that, like, this guy's going to be a star, so why don't we release these when he's a star instead of when he's, like, less of a star? Mm-hmm. Maybe that's what it's all
Maybe
about.
Maybe we're waiting for him to die. So, because this guy's lived crazy already.
We
can just bank this, and as soon as he dies, his discography is going to go through the roof.
That's, right? I mean, that's also it. It's like, do you want to be releasing, you know, you've got this album, you own it, so do you want to be, like, bumping up his price on future albums, you know, like you're saying, or just sort of bank him so he can't, like, rip you off on the money?
Well, and he's working with two different companies here. So they're going to see what the other one does first and then judge whether or not what they have in the bank is better.
That's
right
also
there,
a
and
good
how they
point.
Respond
yeah.
to the market with it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because he's now in a place where he's dealing with companies that have to respond to a market, not just him.
Well, and it's just weird to me because my understanding of the music world is that they build it for the market and release it. And it comes out, you know, lickety split.
That is not supply
and that's just
and
my understanding of the way that. And that's kind of, I mean, like, that's not wrong. That's kind of how the music market works. In this situation, they're not doing it that way. They're like, record it. Let's sit on it for a little while.
Well, this is exactly what it is. This is just the basic laws of economics. This is supply and demand. And this is controlling supply to see what demand is.
Yeah, because, I mean, you have the recording. That's one thing. But, like, to actually release a record takes significant money.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, especially back then.
Yep.
Where, you know, it's not just the pressing costs, it's like the promotion and all of this kind of thing.
Promotion, distribution, and then the tour behind it.
Plus, there's also the fact that, like, in this period, late 50s, early 60s, you know, I'll go back to it again, is, like, people are shifting over where, like, the stereo was not so much a thing in the home, but now it's getting to be a very big thing in the home. Mm-hmm. And, you know.
Literally a very big thing.
Well, no, I mean, because they're sort of, you know, separates are starting to come out. Consoles are still big.
Transistors are still running around, but people are becoming more attached to being able to listen to their own music in their own space.
Yeah, the idea of listening to music in the home and, like, somebody being a music aficionado and having a big collection of records is a new thing, you know?
Yeah, you don't have to go to a place to listen to music. You can be home, but you have to have the money for it.
Right, and it's no longer John down the road that has three LPs that play the same Foxtrot over and over anymore. It's like you said, the vast music collection that's starting to show up. Maybe it is that. Either way, it's a little weird. It's not something
we generally see. It is a little strange, yeah.
It is not something we generally see. So continuing to refine his band, he replaced some of the members as they moved on, or he found people he liked a little bit differently. Not better, just differently. This included adding another up-and-coming sax player, Cannonball Adderley.
Well,
I don't mean to just name-drop greats, but Miles Davis life. So the new version...
The Socrates-Plato relationship is starting to change.
Seeing, right? So the new version of the group would release Porgy and Bess in 1958 before going on to another hugely notable jazz behemoth. Kind of Blue was released in 1959 and has become not only Miles' best-selling album, but the best-selling jazz album of all
time. Well, let's go back a little bit because, like, Porgy and Bess was, like, pretty notable because that was also back then in the late 50s, early 60s. A lot of the music that people bought was show music.
Yep, and that's straight up Gershwin.
You bought music from musicals and this kind of thing. And Porgy and Bess was especially notable because it was the first really big black musical.
It was.
You know? And so that was pretty groundbreaking. And everybody was into it.
Nina covered I Love You, Porgy.
Yeah.
Like, it was very big in black culture.
Everybody
and
had
part
it,
of
but
that.
Like... you know, if you went to somebody's house back then in the early 60s, and they had a stereo, 9 times out of 10, what they would mostly have would be show music like Man of La Mancha.
Yep. That's why there's a zillion of those in the thrift bins nowadays.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, you can see them in the thrift bins. And they, you know, they'd have that kind of music. Was show music was really big. So, you know, this was still, Porgy and Bess was still a pretty big album, but like Kind of Blue was a totally different thing. Because Kind of Blue comes out, and Kind of Blue, I think, is sort of one of the first, like, audiophile records where, like, any idiot can hear that this thing is
good,
really produced well. And it's nice because it's like a small combo, so on any decent stereo, you could just hear something totally different. The placement of the, you know,
of the microphones, the instrument, and
that kind of thing. It did a thing where you don't have to actually have any kind of musical education. You don't have to have...
Very easy to get into.
Yeah, it is. It took all of... It brought it back down to the base level. You know, not having the musical intelligence that you guys do, it makes it easy to be able to listen to something that's well produced on my end. It's like, I can hear this.
Yeah.
You know, you can give me a live Yes album.
Yeah.
And...
Good luck.
Right. But, you know, give me something like that. When I'm hearing them actually do something and it's done well live, I can hear what they're trying to do. It's set up correctly. And then you hear something else. It's like, you know, you get somebody that is kind of a pedant that doesn't understand what's going on, but they can appreciate it.
Yeah, 9 times out of 10, anybody's first jazz record was Kind of Blue.
Was Kind of Blue.
Yeah.
Yep.
You know.
And again, and they love it, they'll remember it.
Biggest selling jazz album of all time.
Yeah, like by far, too.
Even today.
Yeah.
It, nothing else sells Kind of Blue. And I, frankly, especially with, unfortunately, there's been kind of a death in the jazz world, or it's been minimized in the musical scene anyhow, however you want to say it. I don't think there ever will be another jazz album as big as Kind of Blue. It is the jazz album. So, like, that's a couple. The Birth of Cool and Kind of Blue. And then, like, let's stop in the middle for Porgy and Bess and a couple other albums and some live shows. And
After Midnight.
No, there's been,
around Midnight.
I mean, there's been other really big jazz albums. Like, you know, Dave Brubeck's Time Out. Or, Jazz at the Pawn Shop would be another one.
Or Love Supreme.
Yeah, Love Supreme, nobody can get that, but, like, you know, it's notable. nobody buys that as their first jazz album.
You know, it's my answer to that.
But like, in terms of, like, really big jazz albums, you know, there's quite a few of them. Haven't been in a long time. Yeah. But, you know, I think Jazz at the Pawn Shop is probably the last one that I can think of off the top of my head. And that was like mid-60s or something.
Yeah, I mean, maybe just
late 60s.
Jazz found its way into the back corner again. And that is what it is. But this album, fucking world-changing. Not just game-changing, world-changing. The album is significant musically, as Miles started recording his songs in modes rather than traditional chord changes. So this gets a little geeky for a quick second, but I tried to simplify it. This basically gave him and his fellow musicians freedom to... freedom outside of the regular scale construction, the scale, the 8-note scale that we're used to in Western civilization. And they were able to work outside that construction and in turn created a sound that was sometimes more dissonant because they were able to pick tones outside of our standard scales and sometimes a little bit more tonal because the players could approach the bass chord with from different angles than they were normally allowed to. For instance, like taking a note and bending it a quarter step, which causes a different harmony or tonal quality than we're used to in most Western music. It was a huge step out of tune and invited that much more Eastern feeling to music. More simply, it changed the way that people looked at jazz and the way jazz was structured. But like moving to the modal structure was wholly new. And like We all know I'm not a Zappa fan, but anybody who is a Zappa fan understands where modal music can take you. Because he worked very much in that modal structure rather than the direct chord structure. It was, again, new. You have things, I see.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, Thelonious Monk obviously did a lot of this.
Yes.
I still think that, like, you know, maybe he's able to do this because there's sort of, I don't know, two things with jazz going on where you got, like, your basic melody going on. And then you've got your sort of improv side going on. And I think that the improv side of it is what, like, is exciting about jazz, but
yes.
Also what can take people out of jazz.
It is where people tend to leave the genre, yeah.
If you're doing improv, it becomes harder to follow along. It's less like the show music where you know all the lyrics by heart and you know what's going to happen, and people like that. People like that predictability. And so then if you're getting into this improv stuff, it's like, you know, it's a little jarring for a lot of people. It's certainly less easy listening. But if you don't have that, you start getting some very boring jazz. And also a lot of people consider it music without that. To be fundamentally not music. Like, the entire Indian musical system is based upon this. Like, if you right. don't have improv, that's not music to those guys, you know?
That means you're not a musician.
And right.
you're a mimicker.
Yeah, and that's what they're visiting with this exploration into the modal tone, or the modal structure, is that Eastern, let's move freely within the structure kind of approach to music.
Yeah.
That doesn't, like Rupert very succinctly said, isn't the musical that you know all the words to.
Right.
It is something that is, you never know what's coming around the next corner. And if you talk to jazz musicians, they talk about turning the corner or, you know, oh, dude, you had that hook or whatever. But it's not a hook like we know in hip-hop. It's a hook like, didn't know we were going that direction. And it shows, it displays a certain amount of musicianship to be able to stick in that world. Like, you have to know your instrument intrinsically to be able to do it. It's...
Well, there's the type of people that love that basic, here you go, here's my 4-4, here's my anthem, you shook me all night long, to give you an example of it.
Yeah.
This is what they need to get into. And then there's the first time anybody hears My Favorite Thing by Coltrane. You know, it's, you don't realize what you're hearing until it's too late, and then you're like, oh my God, did that just happen?
That's actually an excellent example, because it is taking a musical song.
Yeah.
Everybody knows what's coming next, but then you're like, ba-dup, 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 and...
Are you saying potato, potato, tomato, tomato?
Is his horn changing the words? Like, it is this whole exploration into a world that your mind doesn't generally work in.
And that's where it becomes fun.
I think so.
And that's the difference between fun and safe.
Well, I think it has to do with a little bit of, like, the entire history of Western music, where, like... The basic musical form sort of evolves, and, you know, we get to Bach, where you have sort of the refinement or the invention, or certainly the perfection of sort of the two main themes in Western music of fugue and counterpoint. But both of those are intrinsically referential. In other words, you know, if you have counterpoint, you have, like, one side of the orchestra playing against the other, like, sort of this call and answer thing.
Yeah, exactly. Call and answer is exactly.
Or if you have fugue, you're, you know, it's referential because you're building upon a previous established theme and taking that previous theme forward. Whereas with this sort of improvisation, you're like, we're in this, you know, sort of mode, and now we're going into this one. You know, just because I'm just taking it there.
Yep.
And that's a very, you know, sort of, I think it's actually kind of bad to, like, express it in these terms, but there's no real better one. But that's, like, basically a very non-Western way of looking at things. And it's sort of changing the whole dynamic.
I tried to find different words to use other than the definition between Western and Eastern music, but it really is a move of the Eastern influence into music, it, as we Westerners know it. And I wish there was better words, but it is that.
Well, another way to express it would be, it doesn't really apply to jazz, but it does apply to this idea of not doing fugue and counterpoint. Is the way Ravi Shankar explains it, is that Indian music does not have corners, it has rounded edges. And by that he means you can't be having sort of like in Indian music, you cannot be doing something like you know, Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, where you've got sort of this, you know, counterpoint thing, dun da da da, dun da 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 da,
right?
You know, you can't be doing that because that's a sharp corner.
Okay.
Because you're doing this call and answer thing, and it doesn't work in Indian music. They won't do that. That's bad. So you have to sort of gradually get there rather than doing this striking thing.
It's like being walked down the street being handheld, as opposed to being slapped in the back of the head, like Gibbs style.
And these cats are doing it from, like, walking that very fine line. Again, A Love Supreme, or My Favorite Thing's a wonderful example. When Coltrane's soprano saxophone drops out, and it goes into, I can't remember who the trumpet player on the album is, when it goes into the trumpet player, they're following a ba-da-ba-da-da-ba, it's ba-da, da-da-da. You know, it just each person's intrinsic interpretation of it played out in this, again, creating a modal way of moving through
The idea of doing it, though, is to, like, get to a totally different place at the end than where you were in the beginning without being able to trace the steps. So a really easy way to grasp this, that it's not really easy, but it's the most easy way I can think of to grasp this, is...
Three white dudes talk jazz.
If you consider, like, I think most people have, like, sort of a basic understanding of what Indian music sounds like. Okay. So the simplest way to look at it is the way Indian music would view it in their classical compositions, where you start with the first part of a piece will be known as the alap. The middle part will be known as the chala, and the last will be known as the jor. So, to understand this, the shortest raga ever composed would be George Harrison's Love You Too. So if you think about how that song begins, it begins in a aperiodic, where all the notes are introduced.
Yeah, these are the notes we're going to use.
But it's arrhythmic. There's no rhythm yet.
But then... It's like walking all the characters on stage and showing you these are the people in the play.
Yeah, that's it exactly. But then, as that, like, 15 seconds into that, that counts as the alap, this sort of aperiodic introduction of the notes. Then he goes like... You know. And so he transitions into... a periodic thing where it has a rhythmic beat.
And becomes comfortable.
Exactly. And that kind of human thing. Can grab onto.
But
easily.
It's done very subtly. Yeah. As subtly as you can, attempting to do, you know, a more broad-based thing.
Well,
like
that song's only like 6 minutes long, raga. Right?
No, it's like 3 minutes. Oh. You know, and he's trying, you know, a raga is usually as long as a symphony. Whatever, 20 minutes. Right? But he's trying to do it in 3 minutes to adapt to the raga form.
Yeah.
Which is a little bit like, you know, what Miles Davis is doing here, to adapt the raga form to a pop music form.
Yep.
And that's what he does in that song. Yep. And that subtle transition, even though it's abrupt because it's so
it's
short.
Simply put, it's beautiful. You don't realize you're there until you're there.
If you listen to that song, you can understand what we're talking about here with modality.
Yeah, so this modality movement and the kind of Blue Album is very much exploring that Eastern side and possibly one of his first versions of fusion or one of the first versions of fusion music. So he moves along. Having become a driving force in the jazz world, Miles and his crew follow up Kind of Blue with another classic, Sketches of Spain. Embracing the growing influence of Spanish rhythms and stylings, this is another groundbreaking effort for Miles and the gang. So even more moving into that fusion, because this is a very Latin-influenced album. There's conga drums, and there's flamenco rhythms, and there's things that, again, haven't visited the jazz culture yet, and Miles is doing it first.
I could be wrong about this, but I think that might be the album where he flips out over the cover art. Am I wrong?
I think you're correct. I think I ran across that. I didn't write anything down about that, but I think you're correct.
Well, with this album cover, I forget what the original cover art was supposed to be. But they show it to him, and it had a white woman on the cover. And he didn't like that. And he was
surprised.
He was like, I'm not making this album to have no white woman sitting on the cover. You have to put a black woman on the cover. And that's, unless I'm wrong, and I very well could be, but I think this is the album where he insists upon a black woman on the cover, which was, quite a thing then.
Yeah, exactly. Know? Again, pushing barriers and boundaries, you know?
Yeah, because having a white woman on the cover would have sold copies.
Well, he's not concerned with selling copies. Exactly, at this point,
but
clearly.
He's very clear
about his artistic focus.
But that's the deal, is that he's still dealing with two different fucking companies here.
I think that's over. I think he has done.
Okay, now he's down to one?
Yeah, I think he's down to just Columbia.
Which is a juggernaut trying to sell records. And how do you get your investment back? You sell to the biggest fucking populace that you can. So we need to take this dude and make him palatable for everybody.
Put a white bitch on the cover and call the album Whipped Cream.
Hey, if you want to name the album Cherry Pie, go right ahead.
So
smell the glove.
I like these.
Does this mask smell like chloroform?
Mine was a real album cover, but I like where you guys are going.
Smell the glove. That was a real album cover in a movie.
Does this mask smell like chloroform?
So, you have a greased woman on a leash.
I like Greased Woman on a Leash. Let's make that our album cover.
The difference between sexy and sexist is such a
fine
line. It's
very fine, yes. So continuing at a fevered pace.
It crossed daily here.
Call Eaton Hog on this one.
Yeah, dude, I was at the grocery. Ladies, because of the grocery. What do you do? You got any plans? I record on Sundays. What kind of music? It's a podcast. This does not look like our listener group. Like, what's the name of your podcast? All right. Tell ya. So welcome if this is your first one. Whatever. Anyway, so continuing at a fevered pace, he started recording and releasing live shows as well. His output was compounding fast. Somehow he found time to fall in love again, this time with a dancer named Frances Taylor. The marriage would last only a few years and would be riddled with more of Davis's now notorious odd behavior that kind of bordered on abuse.
Yeah,
it was a short-lived marriage. He's obviously an interesting guy and going to be interesting to deal with interpersonally, and that can be called abuse. I might at some point, but not right now. All the while, Davis had developed an interest in rock and roll. Following bands like Sly and the Family Stone and Jimi Hendrix, he started to incorporate the elements of rock, especially psychedelic rock, into his own music. This culminated in him releasing Bitches Brew, which is blamed that, like, there's an extended bit version of Bitches Brew that's like 3.5-4 hours long. That's most of what I listened to while I was writing this. So, anyway, they released Bitches Brew, possibly the first fusion jazz, like, truly called fusion jazz album touching the rock world. It quickly became a bestseller, and Miles ended up becoming the first jazz musician to grace the cover of Rolling Stone because of it. This album also led the way for other fusion bands to pop up, notably The Weather Report being one of the earliest, as well as allowing rock bands to explore jazz themes more directly than they had been. So this is early to mid-60s, and this is maybe where a lot of our prog rock love ends up coming from. is this ability to fuse multiple styles of music into one place and say, yeah, we can go from a Latin rhythm to a squirmly guitar to whatever. It again, changing the entire musical culture. All Looked Good as the 1970s rolled in. He was making music with lots of music and lots of it. Some of the band members were now out on their own with established careers, and he was known the world over as one of the best jazz musicians of all time. A place he would still hold if he had stopped right there, or decades earlier, he would still hold the place of one of the best musicians of all time.
Yeah, I think so. He just sort of goes down, but he just down here
keeps going.
I don't know.
Well, he keeps going.
I think in the 70s, it sort of takes a downturn.
He was hiring up-and-comers like Chick Corea and eventually Herbie Hancock. So, again, not to drop all the great names, but these are probably the most recent jazz greats. And they're, again, because of Miles. Unfortunately, by the middle of the decade, he would fall into his addictions again. This time, it was mainly alcohol and cocaine. And again, you can look at the scene he was in and kind of see where it came from. Like when you're hanging out with rock musicians and jazz musicians.
Like the mid-70s here?
Yeah. We're early to mid-70s. Of course you're going to end up in...
Well, this is when he gets into the crazy metallic outfits and the weird glasses and he gets like a little bit too fusion.
Mm-hmm.
And burns up.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I don't like the stuff from this period.
That's a common critical review. You're right.
Put me in with the rest of them. I just am not into it.
It was too different from what people were doing, and so his popularity waned. Because, like, you can't be all sparkly outfit and playing rock and roll songs or whatever.
No, I just thought that
not unless you're... cult of personality.
Hmm. A little bit. I thought it was
living
just
color, but there you go. That's.
I thought it was just a little bit like. I don't know. There was something about it where, like, first of all, like, I thought that like a lot of fusion sort of merged a little bit into like easy listening with the heavy presence
that way,
of synthesizers made it a little easy listening
it
to me.
It really started to go that way.
It wore out on me pretty fast. Plus. I felt that there were actually, if you wanted to listen to jazz rock fusion, I felt that there were better bands to listen to, like Return to Forever or Weather Report. You know, I thought that they kind of just did it better than any Miles Davis fusion stuff. I just didn't think it worked that well.
Well, this is one of those times where the student should carry the torch. The master shouldn't try to do this because the master is just, hey, how about you just...
Because that's...
You realize where you are.
Yeah, exactly.
And you just stop.
Exactly.
Okay? And you do your thing. You may want to expand out.
Yeah.
But don't do it because you want to set a trend. Do it because you think it's fun. But there's going to be other people now.
Yeah. Because like if
they carry torch for you.
There's something about it where like Chick Corea is kind of... Chick Corea is not really known... as a piano player. Nobody wants to sit there and listen to Chick Corea play a Steinway grand piano. They want to sit there and listen to like Chick Corea play the synthesizers and make that sound. He's extremely good at it, and that's great. You know, and if you want to hear that, you know, he's going to be in your record collection if you want to hear that synthesizer-y, you know, fusion jazz sound. Plenty
coming
of that.
Back from Montana, going through Spokane, I did look to my left and I saw a Steinway piano outlet. Like, okay, this is the only good thing that Spokane has.
It's also like it starts to I love hearing like great drums and something, but it starts moving the drummer a little bit too much out in front because then you start getting, you know. Jazz drummers, but they're playing a rock set, a rock drum kit. You know, so you got guys like Lenny White sitting there doing like a huge, like, you know, 8-tom fill. And I don't know, it just takes away from the intimacy of what Miles Davis was doing before, where he's got like a 5 to 10 piece combo playing something, and it like sounds better rather than this huge,
you know, again,
multi-track production kind of thing.
Look at the time frame. We're the very end of the 60s, beginning of the 70s. Jam bands are coming.
Well, no, we're in the mid 70s now.
We're in mid 70s. Jam bands are out and prominent now. It's appealing to the culture.
Right, but this is where we were getting, where, well, at least what I was trying to make, where this is where you let the torch carry. You don't keep doing, it's fine if you want to do it for yourself, but don't expect everybody else. The people that you've trained, that have worked underneath you, that right. you have well, fostered and well, you like, have helped grow,
like Rupert mentioned,
they're the ones that are going to continue doing that. They're the ones that are going to be the fusions.
The Weather Report was a perfect example, and one that I brought up earlier, that they are literally fallout from his earlier progressions, and they are taking the now created genre forward and let the new generation lead, maybe. And but at the same time, Miles is still continuing to push some boundaries and some edges, and it's making people uncomfortable. Like, the critical stuff is an issue right now. Like, the critics don't love his work right now, but he's still doing his work as defines it.
But that's because the critics always considered it's not Miles. They aren't looking at...
They did discount it that way at this point in time, right.
This isn't Miles. This is what Miles taught others to do. This is where they went and did things. They learned under Miles and then did their thing. They're all on that. They'll jump that bandwagon all day long.
Right.
But Miles should only do this.
Well, and they're quick to blame him for losing his way during this period.
Well, so were the fans.
Whatever.
So were the fans.
Well...
Because when you find a fan, Trent Reznor had the same thing happen.
He's picking
How dare you change your music?
He's picking up new fans at this point in time because of that, because of his crossover stuff. And some of the rock people are starting to... Like, the rock people have started to listen to him a while ago, but they're really... Like, the rock people are buying Miles Davis albums now, and not the jazz people so much anymore, and... It's causing some critical confusion, and
but the
much
jazz
like the
and blues was
in
really,
and out of the door confusion.
Jazz and blues was really easy to get to jump that hump,
right?
That's really easy.
But the rock and roll gap,
that's a hard curve to walk up for some reason.
So another thing that happened in this time was his first hip replacement. Long ailing from issues with his joints, he had some work done. This will help explain his future stage presence. This decline ended up in Miles taking what amounts to 4 to 5 year hiatus from making and recording music. It is not that he totally stopped, but his addictions had again kept him from productively creating and what people had been used to. Miles would bounce from kind of reasonable to totally self-abusive. The erratic behavior drove most people away, including music producers and such, and family members, and it resulted in Miles' least productive years. So this jump, fueled by possibly the cocaine and alcohol addiction...
Gee whiz.
...and the change into the fusion, like people, like as we just spent time discussing, people decided to walk away. So Miles has kind of fallen from grace, which is unfortunate. But... Luckily, there was hope on the horizon. Somehow, while living this reclusive and addictive lifestyle, he met actor Cicely Tyson in 1979. The couple quickly fell for one another, and she is noted as to have helped him straighten out again. Like, he kind of credits her with, pull your head out of your ass, get off the fucking drugs. And he got off the booze and the coke, and they married in 1981. Going on to have two sons together, Gregory and Miles IV, and getting Miles back into the studio. Somewhere in here, he was again hospitalized, this time for a leg infection, in quotes. I couldn't suss out anything more than that. Again, he was prescribed opiates for pain. So, like, let's get off the coke, but here, take this
Vicodin. Welcome back to heroin.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe not great. I can't confirm, but maybe not great. Continuing his fusion pathway, he started to collaborate with pop musicians, as well as cover pop tunes in his now well-defined Miles way. He ended up recording covers of Michael Jackson's Human Nature, as well as Cyndi Lauper's Time After Time, which one of those I think I'm going to throw a link in the show notes to. But they're both kind of amazing, frankly.
Time After Time is really fucking good.
They're kind of amazing renditions of straight-up pop tunes. Whether critics loved it or not, I think it's
amazing. Fuck off.
Yeah.
I don't listen to music to hear a critic's fucking assessment of it.
Yeah, they were crossovers that critics didn't love, but whatever. I thought they were awesome. He had long ago incorporated what may be the best-known part of his style, the very minimalistic use of his horn. He, unlike all the contemporaries and influences, had inspired a way of not filling all the spaces with sound, which created an anticipation in the music and held interest, especially when paired with the pop of the early to mid-1980s. So, back to some of his roots of don't fill all the space, all that kind of thing, he, with a couple of notes and a bunch of silence, keeps people on the edge of their seats. And this is part of what brings them back to Miles Davis, is further establishing this stylistic characteristic. Let me say "istic" a few more times. So another big thing of note at this time is the change in his stage persona. As I mentioned, he'd had some physical ailments and shit. In direct opposition to the likes of James Brown, Miles was known to be almost disassociated on stage, frequently playing with his back to the audience and or staring at the ground while wearing this, as John brought up earlier, flashy garb, had been expected, perhaps stemming from his now withdrawn way of moving through the world, and perhaps because he was always encouraged to be nothing but himself. He had a way of not interacting with his audience that has always been seen as kind of cool and iconic. Like, there's something about Miles and the fact that he doesn't interact with his audiences that makes him unique that way. With Miles on the charts, another jazz in question during the 1980s, Miles ended up in a musical feud with fellow trumpeter Wynton Marsalis. Wynton, having grown up in a now very notable musical family, publicly called Miles out for not being a true jazz artist anymore because of his constant fusion releases. So what we've been talking about comes to a head a little bit. By 1986, the feud came to the stage at the first ever Vancouver Jazz Festival, which is now a very notable jazz festival. Now, there is a talk that it would that festival might not have existed without this beef in its first year, but either way, while Miles was on stage playing, Wynton decided he would just walk on stage and join Miles. So, I don't know if y'all are musicians, but this isn't generally something you get to
unless you're,
you know, like Miles could do it to Wynton, but Wynton should not be doing it to Miles. Mm. Not to discredit Wynton. He and his family very talented. Either way, Miles initially excused Wynton from the stage. So there's sound recordings. I haven't found a visual recording. You have to listen to it. But initially excuses Wynton from the stage, but then hearkened him back with a dare-like gesture, offering Marsalis a mic for his horn. Wynton plays a pretty decent about 30 seconds before Miles again motions for Wynton to give him what he's got. Like, nah, I meant bring it. It's kind of what Miles says, right? Wynton plays a bit more, and then Miles just kind of shoos him off stage with, like, super, just go away.
Dismissive. Yeah. Yeah, very dismissive.
And
like, go back to the kids' table.
Yeah, it didn't. It was something. There was some attitude on stage.
Yeah.
Wynton recalls this as a normal kind of jazz cultural run up, that helps the community grow. This is possibly the biggest jazz diss of all time. However. Like, just go away.
Go away, child. Go back to the kids' table at Thanksgiving. Yes.
Yeah. Like, and it's Wynton fucking Marsalis. He is a very talented musician. Speaking of jazz greats, and I have seen. So, of course, Miles, and I've seen Branford, too. Of course, Miles moved on, and he follows the feud up with Tutu, another album. This album is laced with synth pop, or synth loops and samples, and beats. And oh my, again, he is called up by the pure jazz crowd.
Right.
But fuck them. He gets a Grammy for it. He follows that up with one of my personal favorites, although I do need a new copy, Aura, in 1985. Aura is a very explorational album. He definitely goes back to his modal jazz, and it is one of my personal favorites. It's Get It. However, again, that album is held for 4 years. It's not released until 89, so they're still doing this shit damn for some reason. It is now 1988, and Cicely Tyson has had enough of Miles. They divorce. She does not speak much about the relationship, and it seems that maybe this was not as bad as the others, but it was probably still questionable. He also released a ton of music during this period, and much of it helped introduce a younger audience to jazz. So, again, attaching to those rock and roll listeners, and his just legendary name now. People are getting into jazz merely because it says Miles Davis on it. With Miles leading the way to the hearts of a new group of jazz listeners during this time, he started to get even more noticed than he had in decades before. He had been the dark influence long enough, and now he was on the way to the next generation. All the fusion he had been chasing finally got some place in the critics' arts, and he started getting some Lifetime Achievement Awards, including the Grammy for Lifetime Achievement. Following this ceremonious granting, he performed with Quincy Jones at the Montreux Jazz Festival on July 8th,
1991. EAUX. Was spelled incorrectly. That's why you had a problem with it.
Either way.
Well, I think Montreux and Newport are probably the two biggest jazz festivals there are.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And so it's July 8th, 1991. He plays with Quincy Jones. And didn't he cover Quincy Jones?
Not yet. I don't believe so.
Either way, he and Quincy performed a number of tunes Mild had not played for decades, but also did a bunch of other songs that were arranged just for him by his longtime coordinator, Gil Evans, who I kind of left out until now, and it was kind of there from the start. It was a gigantic show. A few months later, on September 28th, 1991, so July, August,
September. Gil Evans is the one, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the one whose kid I knew.
Well,
there you go.
Here we go. We're full circle.
Miles Evans, yeah.
So a few months later, on September 28th, 1991, Miles joined the Dream Band in the Sky at the age of 65. He passed from complications related to pneumonia and respiratory failure. Shortly after that, he won a Grammy again for his recording with Quincy in 1993 because he's just that kind of fucking cool. And after his death, Miles has remained a bit of a controversial, but a bit controversial by being called out by his sons as abusive and writing them out of the will. So the sons were written out of his will. I know it's kind of a shitty thing, but that happened. Miles also arguably achieved superhero status by today's measures, so you'll have to struggle with that on your own, but whatever. His legacy is carried on by his daughter and some other relatives, but still not his sons. So, like, his daughter and them run MilesDavis.com. And that's the end of the story. Because, well, he deed. If it wasn't clear by my writing and talking already, I have mad love for Miles Davis. He is one of my favorite jazz performers. I was not as aware of all of the changes that he made in the jazz world as I am now. I was pretty good. But he really established what we know as jazz from starting at the bebop age when he was a 17-year-old and moving into, well, big band almost at 17 and moving through bebop and into fusion and perhaps making fusion an actual thing. The man is brilliant, and I will continue to keep him on high rotation, and was brilliant. And it's just hard to deny the musical genius of the man, and I'm glad the world allowed him to do it.
I've got nothing but love for this guy. I really do. Miles Davis and John Coltrane are my two. They're my go-tos. That's just all there is to it. That's just where it is. for the majority of the drive to Montana, I just put put Miles Davis in there because I got a shit ton of it. And I just let it go. And you can go from just the oldest to Time After Time, which I love too. And fuck what the critics say. I don't care. I like it. And here's where it boils down to. It's music is still something that you have to personally like. You don't need to understand what makes music. You just need to understand that this is something you like, and it's okay to like it. And he was responsible for creating Coltrane. Well, not creating, but certainly helping Coltrane along. So there's two of my best and deepest loves wrapped up in one little happy shot, and they worked together for a while, and it was great. And good God, the man, in all of his problems, in all of the things that he did wrong, he did so many things right, too. The body of his work certainly outweighs the sins of his being.
Ooh, I like that.
So I've always thought Miles Davis is kind of an interesting character. He's one of the musicians I sort of will cite that, like, if somebody's a really bad person, does that invalidate their work? Because I'm surprised you left it out. At one point, like, I think it was in the late 50s or early 60s, Miles Davis takes a break outside of a club. A cop comes up and says, what are you doing? And he's smoking a cigarette outside. A cop comes up and says, what are you doing here?
And he ends up in the cop car. And
he ends up in a brawl. And it's basically, you know, a racial brawl. Like, in other words, if he was a white guy standing out in front of the club, this wouldn't have happened. So, you know.
That's appropriate for the time.
It was either in the mid or the late 80s. I think it was, like, kind of interesting because, like, 60 Minutes decided to do a piece on Miles Davis. And it was sort of interesting because, as 60 Minutes is wont to do, certainly in that time, anytime there was a black guy they had to interview, they sent out Ed Bradley. And it was just like, you know, okay, fine. So they interviewed Miles Davis in his house, and Ed Bradley just sort of says it. And says to Miles Davis, like, so you don't like white people, do you? And Miles Davis is like, no, I don't like white people at all. And it's like, well, why? And instead of referring to this beatdown story two decades previously, he says, like, okay, so when I was sitting in this house and I realized, like, when I got a red Ferrari, I kept getting pulled over. So I had to actually call the police and said, this is Miles Davis. I own a red Ferrari. Could you please just write it down that that's the black guy driving the red Ferrari? So you could sort of understand what is racism? You could sort of understand how he gets there. But at the same time, like, I think it's actually a little bit beyond that. This was a guy who just did not like people. I think he just did not like people. And if you can't get along with Cicely Tyson, who's, like, one of the nicest people in the world, like, if you can't get along with her, like, you've got some serious problems because she's a genuinely nice person. So I think he just didn't like people and, unfortunately, was in a business that you're going to be with a lot of people that you're going to have to interact with on a pretty close basis all the time. This sounds like something that friends do.
I thought we were friends.
I'm extremely uncomfortable with that.
I know. Do you know